Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet.
Dave Saldana with us. He's an Emmy Award-winning journalist and a civil rights attorney with a long history in advocacy communications. His news career includes publications in all media, broadcast, print, and online. He's run the gamut from small weekly newspapers to big market television and MTV News. As an attorney, he's handled First Amendment cases and workers' rights. All those claims, his communications experience includes tenure in communications director for United Electrical, Radio, and Machine Workers of America, the UE, and adjunct professor of journalism at Iowa State University, an expert on journalism ethics and standards. He's also served as deputy editorial director at Media Matters for America. And let us say, Dave Saldana, hi, welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you, Michael.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Dave, we're looking at something very interesting, the AT&T, the mobile merger. If it had not have been blocked, what could have happened? What was the effect that it would have had on the average user?
Well, I hate to sound melodramatic or like I'm overstating the case, but it would have been a very serious detrimental impact for consumers across America. What we would have seen is the national market go from four carriers to three, and with actually only two carriers, Verizon and AT&T, with about 80% of the market. That's an enormous market share. In order to get that level of concentration, you would have to have the top eight oil companies combined.
Now, by the way, go ahead.
But a key difference there is, you know, there's a gas station on every corner, and so there's plenty of competition. And at gas stations, they don't tie you into a 2-year contract that says that you can only buy their gas for 2 years.
You know, another consideration also, and you were, the competition word is really there. The competition is stifled. If there is no competition, then there is price fixing, and that's when we get into antitrust. And I think that the moves that were made were absolutely beneficial to anybody living in this country today. We can't get into a situation where one major owner controls what goes on in the marketplace, because then you lose your ability to be able to go next door to find a better price for the same quality of service or merchandise.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. And, you know, that is already in play. The market is already so concentrated. I mean, AT&T and Verizon have a wildly dominant control over the market right now. T-Mobile and Sprint are distant third and fourth level players. And we've seen the way this plays out, because AT&T had a monopoly on the iPhone for several years until earlier this year when Verizon got the iPhone. Now, a lot of people thought, well, this will be great. Now they'll actually have to compete for subscribers with better rates, better service. Well, what happened was Verizon came out with a pricing plan for the iPhone that was actually much worse than AT&T's. But instead of selling itself as the lower choice or lower cost option, AT&T actually made its pricing plan worse to match Verizon's.
Now, by the way, when you take a look at this, and in your press release, which I think is extremely important to look at, it's the possibility of the approximately 20,000 jobs cut also. And the question that I would really have when you take a look at this, we've got sophisticated companies. The corporate heads of these companies are no dummies, and they've got a tremendous amount of backup. It just surprises me to think that they would move ahead with a plan like this, knowing full well that it's going to get stopped. The Justice Department would not allow this to happen, because if this did happen, it would be going against the grain of everything that that our rule of law stands for.
Well, I'm glad that it came out the way that it did, but you know, to be perfectly honest with you, there was a lot of nervousness among consumer advocates as to whether this was actually going to play out the way that it fortunately did, because the Justice Department has not always stood four square with the antitrust law. I mean, we can look at the Comcast-NBC merger, which created a mega corporation, the likes of which has never been seen in the American economy. We've got one company that owns the means of production, the means of distribution, and the content that's being produced, you know, top to bottom, and all of the means of distribution, for that matter. We were very very upset with the Department of Justice for not stopping that merger. So we were optimistic, but only cautiously so, that they would step up and do the right thing here. And frankly, we're extremely glad that they did.
Well, by the way, just out of curiosity, Dave, why do you think that the Justice Department did take this stand? I mean, there had to be something to stimulate them, to move them to get into this direction, because if they've, as you said, been weak in the past on standing strong for something, now all of a sudden we have a completely different feel here. What do you think it was? What was that turning point for them?
Well, there are a couple of things that come to mind, and at the risk of sounding self-congratulatory, consumer advocacy groups like Free Press and our friends at Public Knowledge and the Media Access Project mobilized an enormous amount of public support to stop the merger. You know, hundreds, thousands of everyday citizens sent in their letters to the FCC saying, we don't want this. This is bad for us. This is bad for the economy. That's step one. Another step is, there is, if you look at the record and the evidence that AT&T put forth, there is just no way that they could say that this is anything but anti-competition. You know, and in fact, your listeners may be aware that a couple of weeks ago, an AT&T lawyer mistakenly put in an unredacted document into the public record, that is, that the confidential information was not scrubbed from it. And what that document said was, in January, early January, AT&T considered but rejected a plan that would have built out its 4G network to rural America, to 97% of the population of the country, at a cost of $3.8 billion. They rejected that plan. A short time later, they announced this planned merger with T-Mobile at a price of $39 billion, which they said was absolutely necessary for them to meet their build-out goal of 97% of the public. What that tells me, what that should tell anybody paying attention, is this merger was not about meeting its build-out goals. This merger was about destroying a competitor, about taking one competitor out of the market. And God bless them, the Department of Justice was very clear on the fact that T-Mobile has been a low-price competitor, has been an innovator, has been a spur on the market that has been keeping the big players, Verizon and AT&T, honest. And getting rid of that would have been devastating to consumers.
Realistically, if you look at this, the $38 billion, 36, whatever the number was, to buy would have been chump change based on what they could have made over the next 15, 20, 30 years. So in essence, it's not so much what they spend, it's what they're going to make. And at base, it's bottom line. And on their side, strategically, to eliminate a competitor by buying up the competitor is brilliant, if you can get away with it.
Sure, sure. And that's what we were afraid of, that they had mobilized an army of lobbyists. They had spent hundreds of millions of dollars in lobbying and campaign contributions to build up the political support in Washington, that we were afraid that that was going to win the day. Luckily, that didn't happen. You know, AT&T has been extremely cynical throughout this process. You know, if you look at even as recently as this very morning, you know, they announced that they were going to repatriate 5,000 jobs that had been outsourced, call center jobs that had been outsourced, but only if the merger is approved. Now, for somebody who's looked very, very closely at the details of this deal, AT&T has made hundreds of millions of dollars in profit every quarter for the last very long time. So they actually have, you know, cash in pocket at any given time to repatriate those 5,000 jobs. So in what they were trying to do is paint themselves as good corporate citizens. We're going to bring these jobs back to America. Actually, what they were doing is holding a gun to the heads of American workers, saying 5,000 jobs that we could bring back in a second are going to go away unless we get this deal. That's an extremely cynical move.
Yeah, let me hold you up for a minute, because there's something critical I want to touch on, because we're starting to run out of time. And I noticed that your website is www.savetheinternet.com or www.freepress.net, etc. Now, important is part of what you're getting out the information is to basically save the internet so it's not controlled, it's not looked at, and it's allowed to be as it is today.
Yes, that's an enormous part of our organization's goals. Free Press believes in an open exchange of information as a vital component to democracy. And anything that interferes with that, government interference or corporate interference, is detrimental to society. So we believe that the internet that we have today, that was founded on the principle that every bit of information is treated equally, that corporate gatekeepers can't charge admission for content that they disapprove of, that they can't sell, for instance, this is an example I like to use with a lot of folks. Say that you have a local pizzeria that you prefer over the big chains, the Domino's, the Papa John's, the what have yous. Let's say that you dial that place because you want to order a pizza, and the operator comes on and says, we're sorry, but we can't get that call through right now. You'll have to wait 5 minutes. Or we can put you through to Domino's, Pizza Hut, or whatever whatever chain pizza restaurant has paid them for that service. People would throw up their hands and light torches and march on the phone company. Well, that's what we're trying to prevent from happening on the internet, that favored nation status that lets big corporations buy their way into the public to the exclusion of innovators, of competitors, of small entrepreneurs.
Now, by the way, isn't the AT&T Mobile merger an example of what you're talking about, even though it's framed in a different light?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Okay. The AT&T, the merger. If the merger would have happened, it would have eliminated competition. It would have eliminated the entrepreneur, the smaller businesses that are doing something similar. So the AT&T...
Absolutely. The legacy companies, of which AT&T and Verizon are two of the big survivors of the Ma Bell breakup of the 1980s, they already have enormous advantages over newcomers. If you allow them to continue to consolidate power, basically rebuilding Ma Bell, but in two separate entities, that prevents any newcomer from breaking in, because they don't have the wireless spectrum that they can compete over. They don't have the infrastructure that they would have to buy into, and the dominance of two key players in any market works to the detriment of anybody trying to break into that market.
Dave, we're out of time. Can you give us again the website to find you at?
Sure. Freepress.net is our main website. We also have stopatt.savetheinternet.com. We also have savethenews.com.
Wonderful.
Very grateful to that you have me on, Michael, and I hope your listeners got a lot out of this.
Dave, one other thing. What can the average person do to help out?
Keep paying attention. Really, what happened here today was a major victory for people paying attention, getting active, and saying to their legislators, saying to the people who we put, who we hired to make things happen here, getting them to do the right thing by the public. Keep up and be active.
Wonderful. Hey, Dave Saldana, thank you so much for joining us.
Not a problem. Thank you, Michael.
Take care. Good night.
Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see.
are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk. Where are we, Susie?
After
dark. I got it. One of these days, I'll remember. You get a little older, it happens to the best of you. Arne Schor's with us. He was born in Europe during World War II and educated in both England and Germany. He began writing as a teen as an outlet to express his horror of what he saw from the war. He currently lives in Florida. His book is To the Devil His Due. Arne, hi, welcome to the show.
Hey, good evening. Thank you for having me on the show.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, the book in and of itself, Good and Evil, The Devil and Angels, and Demons and Al-Qaeda. You know, when we really deal with demons and angels, etc., are they really here? Are they among us and we don't see them? Is it something that's been fantasy in people's minds, or is there a reality that we better sit back and take a look at that does affect us even though it doesn't come out in an obvious or conscious level?
Well, like anybody's saying, I'm not completely certain, but I got to tell you, when I look at a Muammar Gaddafi or an Adolf Hitler, I certainly take a long, deep breath and think about it.
And no question about it. You know, and one of the ways that I've looked at this also is somebody once said that we don't have free will. You know, however that you define or believe in God, if there was a God, we wouldn't be killing. He wouldn't let us do this, that, and the other thing. And my response to that at the time was, we were given free will. And if you want the killing to stop, don't do it. You know,
that's right. I agree with that completely. But I think that men of goodwill are assisted by the forces of good. And I deal with this in my book in a very satirical way. I don't want everybody to think that it's some solemn biblical thing. It isn't at all.
Sure.
It's pure satire. For example, the devil is portrayed as the head of a multi-billion international media corporation, and he uses print and television to manipulate the world towards nuclear war and Armageddon. Does that remind you of anybody? And this is balanced out in my novel by the U.S. president being an unawakened angel. None of the human characters. There's a plot to destroy the United States or at least six major cities with nuclear weapons smuggled in from Korea and Iran. And none of the human characters involved are aware of the struggle going on around them. And as I say, the bad guys are assisted by Lucifer and the demons of hell, and the good guys are assisted by the angel Gabriel and the forces of heaven, and the good guys win in the end. And it reflects, as an immigrant, it reflects my belief in the sacredness of America, and I'm sure that heaven feels at least as strongly about it as I do.
No, absolutely. You know, a couple of the things that you've said in your press release, you know, To the Devil a Zoo not only entertains but offers food for thought of the role for good and evil. And the other thing that I'm going to take a look at this are, you know, are money and power really the root of all evil? And a long time ago, many, many years ago, one of the things that I learned to distinguish was this. It is not money that's the root of all evil. It's the love of it. It's when it controls you. So in and of itself, it's the way that it's handled.
Well, I think another ingredient is what's done with it.
Yeah.
I mean,
loud and clear. I got it.
Loud and clear. I mean, we have a Bill Gates who gives away a fortune to good causes, and there are a lot of people like that, particularly in this country. And I think that that's the forces of good at work. And then, of course, there's the other end of the stick. And what I've done is I've tried here to express all of our outrage and anger following 9/11. And I chose specifically the theme of world terrorism and attacks on the United States to try and convey my feeling that we are all here subject to forces that we not only don't see, but we rarely even think about.
I want to touch on something. One of your talking points, Armageddon, and will our world indeed come to an end? If the country goes the way that it's going right now, and I was born in this country, my dad immigrated in the early 1900s, and I love my country, and I'm a former Marine, and I will die for my country if I have to, and I will say the Pledge of Allegiance, and I'll sing the national anthem. That said, I think the way that the country's going now and the separation between the races, the separation between the genders, the political, I don't even know what to call it anymore, that nobody can get together. It's not about right or wrong. It's about who's going to win. And that in and of itself can give us a symbolic Armageddon.
Yes, I think so. I couldn't agree with you more. And as a former German, I have tremendous problems with the similarities that it's not too difficult to cast between my new country and my former country and the position we're in now.
No, absolutely.
I find it totally alarming that the two major political parties are completely unable to talk to each other and that patriotism is used as a sledgehammer against your opponents, just as it was in my former country in the 1930s. I find that terrifying. I have a daughter serving in the U.S. Navy, and my wife and I did 25 years in the U.S. Navy. And I find this change of direction over the last couple of decades to be appalling.
Go ahead.
When I got to America, it was the sacred place I was expecting. Americans were charming, hardworking, courteous, and had a terrific worldview. In some form or fashion, to a large degree, this has all melted away, and we're in danger of becoming the most selfish, self-indulgent people on the planet.
Well, that's an entitlement thing, and let me tell you what I've seen also. I was born in 1942, and I saw the 40s.
We're the same age.
Oh, okay. Wait. How's this? When is what month will you turn the magic 69?
I'm turning the magic 67 this month.
Ah, 67. Ah,
well,
okay.
Actually, the one we're going into tomorrow.
I
was born in 1944.
Ah, I got you. So my 2 years, we got the elder wisdom over here, right?
That's right. I'll call you sir for the rest of the interview.
Okay, thank you. It works really well. But I saw the 50s here, which was completely different. I saw the transition from the 60s, the 70s, the 80s. And I have watched all of this go on and go down. And let me tell you what I'm seeing when you talk about the comparison. If you go back to the 30s with Hitler before the Second World War, what he did is he nationalized the banks, he nationalized the education system, he nationalized the businesses. And if you take a look at what he did, it's almost identical to what's going on here now. And there's a big battle about it. And if we're not very careful, we are not going to be who we were that we became very proud of. The feeling of the rest of the world about us is not the greatest, but when somebody's in trouble, who did they come to? They come to us to help.
Absolutely right. Where did I come?
Yeah.
Completely beaten out as a growing up. I was appalled at the things I saw, both as a child and as a teenager. And I read a copy of the Declaration of Independence when I was about 19. I finished reading it with tears in my eyes, and I knew I was coming here. Because I hold those truths to be self-evident, too.
No, I got you loud and clear. And what I do not understand today, for the life of me, I will invite anybody to come here legally. I will invite anybody to come here. But the one thing that I've always had a problem with is this. If you come from a particular culture and you've run away from that culture because it was damaging to you, you were frightened of it, why bring it here and try to recreate it? That one I will never get.
That's absolutely right. I, for example, could never contemplate living in a place where I didn't speak the language reasonably well. And I find it, it makes me shudder that in Germany, Britain, France, and here, we have huge slabs of immigrant population who refuse to learn the language. That's like squatting in a house. You know, you're just taking all the benefits and not contributing anything. I hate that.
Absolutely. And by the way, the book in and of itself, is it, I have it in front of me, by the way. Arndt, is it set up in such a way that even though it's entertaining and it has particular characters that, you know, represent whether they're angels, devils, etc., is it something where people are really going to get that message?
Well, if you look, it's on Amazon, and if you look at my reader reviews, they're all 5-star. And in the written reviews, people indicate that they got it.
Good.
It's the most rewarding part of getting published, actually, and it's the reason I'm working on a second book.
This is great. Now, by the way, I appreciate what you've done here. I can see what you've done here. And the messages have got to go out. And if we can't take it literally, then we're going to have to take it symbolically. We're going to have to take it.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's just something I wanted people to think about, was that we're not necessarily on our own here. And things may not be quite as black as they seem on occasion.
And I got that one loud and clear. And by the way, I want to thank you very much for being here. I really like what this is about, and I like what you're doing, and I hope everybody gets the message. And when you get the second book, get all the Radio Susie, and we'll bring you back on.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you very much for having me on your show.
Oh, take care.
I've enjoyed talking to you enormously.
Great. Good night.
Good night.
Some of these days, you'll feel so lonely. You're gonna miss my hugging, you miss my kissing, you may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you're got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me in wrong, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. Yeah, I'm gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so soon. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days my hugging, you're gonna miss my kissing, you may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you're for you.
Yeah. Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. He's back. Norris Barron, director of the Emergency Preparedness Institute, providing research and training about developing next practices in emergency management to respond to the new realities. And they are very real out there that America has faced since 1911. His latest book is When Disaster Strikes Home. Norris, hey, welcome back.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Excellent.
Okay, let me tell you what happened with the preparedness, and I should have listened to you, okay? Now, you know where I'm at. I'm right outside of Milwaukee. Everything's fine. My sister's daughter and her two daughters and two dogs and cat were in, where were you? West Virginia? Virginia. And they had to evacuate a week ago. So I'm sitting here with 10 animals in a house full of people. And I don't have, I'm not prepared. Help.
Well, gee.
Yeah.
You should have called me.
I don't. I said to Radio Susie, get Norris. You don't know what to do. You know, by the way,
that may be a bit more of a challenge than I think.
Now, by the way, we talk about emergency preparedness. It's the P word. That is the key. And I think now than ever, that I think every home should have your book in it now, because if somebody thinks that they don't have to have it, you take a look at what happened on the East Coast and all up and down the East Coast, that they never thought anything like that would happen. And by the way, there's also the possibility of earthquakes there. So you've got hurricanes, you've got floods, you've got all of these things going on. Millions of people without electricity right now. And guess what? Nobody was prepared.
Well, I think it's entirely possible to draw a slightly different conclusion. I think a lot of people were prepared. I think a lot of people bailed out when they should have. The question was, what were they prepared for?
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, I think the media did a really good job of telling people, hey, it's going to be a waterlogged hurricane, and the real damage is going to come afterwards. And I'm not sure a lot of people bought into that. But, you know, the problem is, it's what you don't know that you don't know.
Yeah.
That's the problem. And a lot of people just didn't understand that.
Yeah, and I think that one of the things that I would suggest to anybody like yourself to add to the preparedness package, Prozac.
Did you say Viagra or Prozac?
No, Viagra, no. At that stage of the game, I don't think you'd want Viagra. It's Prozac that you would have to have. Susie just fell off the chair.
You know, it's a wake-up call. I've said for 10 years now that managing disaster, it's up to you. This is all about you. Your family safety is your responsibility. And when I go out and train and teach people, I tell them, you need to consider the fact you are the first responder, not the police, not the fire. You're there right now, on the line, where the action's at, and in a lot of cases, they couldn't respond during the storm, and now they can't respond to even get to you. So you need to be self-sufficient.
Now, by the way, one of the things, one of the questions, major questions that you ask, which I think is critically important, and especially now, there's going to be a lot of people sit back and say, oh, my goodness, you know, why is having a disaster plan critical? Turn the news on.
Well, I think the bottom line is it's about hope. It's about having the feeling of comfort, knowing that you're going to be safe, feeling good, feeling in control. That's something we're not used to being not involved with. I tell people all the time, listen to me, read the book, take the steps necessary, become the CEO of your disaster preparedness plan, and don't live a nightmare, which is what is going on right now on the East Coast in a big way. Michael, I'm getting tired of seeing people suffer when it's avoidable. It's too bad. There are just so many things we could have done. We can't stop the water. What we can do is we can certainly manage our response, and I think that's really important. You know, I've been through this. We've had two major storms in the Chicago area this year where we were without power for several days. I'm glad that despite the refrigerator not working and all that sort of thing, we had the tools in our house, my wife and I, our kids are not with us, but we had the tools in our house to be able to manage very well, even with our three dogs and the two of us. We had, you know, the food and the clothing and the shelter and the communications that we needed to be able to get along with. And I got to tell you, I also lived through Wilma I think it was in 06, with my children in Florida. And, you know, Dad, we're going to be okay. We're going to be okay. And through my pushing, they ended up doing what I asked them to do. I told them, I said, you better read the book. And they made out just fine. They made out just fine.
Now, by the way, okay, let's start from the beginning. I pick up disaster strikes home. What do I learn? What do I get out of it that's going to open my eyes and turn the light bulb on?
You're going to learn that, number one, you're not alone. There's a lot of other people that are going to be similarly situated. Safety and comfort, it's your responsibility. It's also your desire. You want to be safe, and you want to be comfortable, and you want your family to be comfortable. You also are going to learn that there are options and choices, lots of options and lots of choices. Disaster preparedness or disaster itself does not have to be, as you say, the Prozac moment. There are ways in which your personal safety can be managed, and I'll show you how. You'll learn how, and I think that's so important. You'll learn what you don't know, and you'll learn the tools, and you'll feel good, you'll feel in control, and you know, you'll be able to manage your way through it. You'll maybe be one of the few. As I say, you can't stop the water, but what you can do is you can manage your response. You don't have to go crazy.
How critical is a generator?
I'm sorry?
How critical is a generator? Well, you were talking, I'm thinking generator. I don't know why, but how critical is a generator?
Obviously, in certain instances, a generator is very critical. If you need medical equipment to operate off of power, that it's obviously it's very critical. But, you know, look, people go on camping trips all the time without a generator. If you have flashlights and you have, you know, the tools that we talk about in the book, you'll be able to go out just fine. You don't have to necessarily spend the money for a generator. If you want that luxury, if it's important to you, or if you have a real need for it, it's okay. But it also has a lot of danger to it, and it has to be managed properly. And storage of gasoline is tough. You know, and not everybody's capable of going out and getting, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40 gallons at the moment that they really need it. So we need to take that into account. The other thing I recommend is don't buy a generator. Buy with a neighbor. Share it. Say, cut the cost.
Oh, yeah.
Have both people managing it so that now you don't have to wake up at 3 in the morning to refill it. Somebody else can do it, or maybe you'll do it one night. So there, again, are ways of learning tricks and ideas and strategies to be able to say, you know what, we can get through this. We're going to be okay.
Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to go to my next-door neighbor, which is about 3 acres away, and I'm going to say, I'm not mad at you anymore for not plowing my driveway last winter. Let's buy a generator.
There you go. That'll work.
Oh, I know. I like it. I like it. Okay. All right. Let's do it this way. Let's take myself, for instance. I spent these 20-some-odd years in Alaska. I learned how to survive. I learned how to live if I have to live. All right. And we had outhouses at times. Not at the house, but there was an outhouse outside the house just in case. So we were prepared for things at 40 below when the electricity and everything else went out, or you got stuck out in the middle of nowhere with your car. And I've camped out and I've been up rivers and whatever. So I got a feel of it. But you take somebody like Radio Susie, with all due respect, there's some things she's phenomenally great at. But if the power went out in her house tonight, she would have no idea what to do. You know, what happens if you can't flush the toilet? And I'm not trying to be a smart guy, but there are people, they just don't know. And I really believe the book is for people who know, but more important, it's the people that don't know, have no idea what to do to survive if something like this occurs.
And that's why we wrote the book the way we did, so that it covers all of these kinds of ideas that you're talking about, whether it be for food, clothing, shelter, cleanliness, all of those sorts of things. You know, we try to help people become very creative and become Boy Scouts for the moment. It's not that difficult, but more importantly, I'll tell you what, I've done lots and lots of programs for first responders around the country in the last several years. And I'm amazed at how attentive they are, and I'm amazed at how many of them come up to me. These are professional first responders, police, fire, municipal workers, and say to me, you know, I never thought about that. That was a great idea. I never thought about that. I'm just, you know, it's not that I'm just filled with ideas, but I took the time at a point in my life when I needed to learn these things for my own benefit, my own family, And I went ahead and I said, I'm going to come up with as many ideas, as many tips and strategies as I can. I put it in one book, and then I created a workbook so that people could actually build a plan and look at some of the possibilities so that, you know, at the right moment, you don't need to read the book. You need to read it before. But I think there's a certain degree of reality that we need to be able to take and say, hey, this could happen to us. And unfortunately, I think there's a wake-up call in what happened last weekend.
Oh, absolutely. Now, a couple of things also. And for me, it's very critical. What about pets? What do you do with pets in a disaster? What happens if their food is destroyed? What happens if you run out of water? What do you do in cases like that?
If you're prepared properly, those things probably won't happen, even if you get evacuated in an emergency. Now, the only exception, I would say, is people that get evacuated from their residence in the middle of the night because of a fire aren't going to have any of these kinds of things. But at least if you have a what we call a go bag, it could be a small suitcase, one for each family member, where we have the three or four or five most important things that we need, including one for the pets, including one for seniors, including people with special needs, so that you can just grab and go. At least you have a fighting chance of being able to, you know, redefine your approach, to deal with this very, very bad situation. I'm all about asking the right questions. I'm all about asking family members to pitch in and help and share their thoughts. You got to make this a family kind of a project so that when we really need to be at the point of needing a plan, we know exactly what to do. You know, it's like the airline pilots. When something goes wrong in the cockpit, he doesn't need to think about it. He knows exactly what to do when he has all the tools at his hand that he can possibly have to make a safe landing.
Norris, what about when it comes down to what about, and I was taught years and years and years ago, and I still have one, a handheld radio, just a regular radio that runs on batteries, because when the time comes and you can't get in, you can't get your internet, you can't get this, you can't get that, it really boils down to, you got it. What about a radio?
I'm a big believer in, obviously, battery-operated radios. I'm a bigger believer in the hand-crank radios. I love two-way radios that allow you to communicate with people within a reasonable distance. I think we should go back to learning ham radio and shortwave radio communications because they're independent. They require their own power and their own antenna. They don't require any outside source. I think all of these lesser technology-related types of products are excellent, and they're very, very reasonably priced.
See, here's what the problem is, okay? I have a 12-year-old sitting across from me. When are you going to be 13? Okay, you're forgiven. Okay, now, all right. What's an outhouse?
An outhouse is
this one's smart. I forgot she came from Alaska, too. It's a porta potty. It's a place where you go to the bathroom. I forgot she was from there. She knows. But if you ask most people what an outhouse is, they won't know.
No, that's true. They won't know, but I think there are other ways of being able to deal. Well, I know there are other ways of dealing with those kind of problems because we talk about that in the book. I'll give you three different ways. I won't do it on the air, but I'll give you three different ways in which you can be able to create a temporary portable bathroom that can accommodate a family for a week without any problem.
And it's called get a shovel. But
no, it's not. No, it's much more creative and much more sanitary than that.
Oh, I love my shovel, though. You know, and they sell these things.
Do you get the point that there are little tricks, little techniques that I can share with you, that I do share with you. You've seen the book. Take a look at it.
Yeah.
Look at some of the checklists. Look at some of the just the ideas that are just so good common sense. Think as we used to say, there's things that we see around the house all the time, but we want to make sure that we have them ready and available for us.
But you see, Norris, I have the advantage because I have the book. I want to create it for those people that don't have the book out there. And this is something I would never let go because we see what is going on today. I don't know what's going on. The earthquakes are, look what happened in Japan. The earthquakes are worse. The hurricanes are worse. I mean, my goodness, it's rocking here. And there are also faults that run, through the Midwest, and there are some in New York City. And if we ever had a major earthquake, there are a lot of people who are not prepared for it because they've never been exposed to it. They would have no idea what to do in the middle of one.
Well, Michael, I've made it possible for just about anybody to take advantage of and have the benefit of the book, because the smartphones today are so available and computers are so available that I've got the book now converted onto Kindle and in the ebook format. And for the month of September, because it's National Preparedness Month, I put the book up on Amazon for 99 cents. So anybody can get the book. There's no reason not to. There's no reason not to at least have it like you'd have the Boy Scout manual handy.
Yeah. I mean, but now how do I get it for 99? Oh, do you take payments?
I take payments, yes. 99 cents, Michael. I take payments. You can go to Amazon, Kindle, 99 cents. You can download it. You can go to my website, getpreparedtoday.org, and you can get the workbook. Now you've got the tools that you need, and your reward is going to be having this easy-to-read and easy-to-follow manual, and you're going to have just a really affordable and a real easy way to develop the strategies and the ideas so that when, the unexpected happens, you'll be prepared.
And that's the key. Now, is it going to be under Disaster Strikes Home when we go to the website?
Yes, when Disaster Strikes Home, Amazon Kindle, or you can buy it in print. It's on my website also, and it has a companion workbook.
Okay, now which is the 99-cent one?
The book.
Oh, the book is 99 cents.
The book is 99 cents.
You're kidding me.
No, 99 cents for the month of September because it's National Preparedness Month.
I love every. How do you go wrong with that?
Well, you can't go wrong with it. I wish everybody would do it. Not because I want to sell books. I made a commitment 10 years ago when I could not find my own children on September 11th. I was a risk manager for 30 years, and on September 11th, a disaster strikes this country, and me, the disaster preparedness expert, had no communication plan for his own kids. Never expected it. I decided that if that's my problem, it's got to be your problem. And I created the materials to go out and do training, and I created the book and the workbook, and I spent the last 10 years talking to people, working with people, giving them the hope that everybody needs. I've been on the radio since Friday night talking about this all over the country, and I hope I've helped some people become at least better prepared. I know there's a heck of a lot of people that are just really, really feeling the effects of this of the storm. But it was my intention to try and help as many as I could.
99 cents, huh?
Yep.
Good. Yeah. Okay. I'm. That one got me off my chair. All right. So,
yeah,
by the way,
I'm always full of surprises.
I know. I got that loud and clear. All right. One more time with the website. We're running out of time now.
www.getpreparedtoday.org or Amazon.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Norris Baron, thank you so much for joining us.
Michael, thanks so much for having me.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
That's all. That's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand of holding leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Well, that's all. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Susan Marshall up next.
Yeah, it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all.
Susan Marshall with us. She's the president of Executive Advisor LLC, How to Grow a Backbone, 10 Strategies for Gaining Power and Influence at Work, and creator of the Backbone Institute. I'm going to introduce her now, but I don't know if she's going to like what I'm going to say. And then again, too, if I don't say it right, somebody else might not like it. I'm just kind of not sure what I'm going to do, but somehow I can find confidence, I think. Hey.
What happened to you, man? Where's your mojo going?
I'm waiting to find my confidence. 5 steps to regain lost confidence.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm ready.
You know what? It's you think about, goodness, the things that have happened to so many people in this country over the last couple of years. Successful people, happy people who are motoring along, who have since lost jobs, lost homes, lost life savings in many cases in the market, in the stock market,
sure.
Getting divorced, you know, alienated from kids. So there are some real serious reasons for people to have lost their confidence. And then there's a whole nother group of people. You know, if we're at 9% unemployment, that means we're at 91% employment.
Yes.
And still, there are an awful lot of people who still have their jobs, who still have their homes, you know, whose lives are still pretty much what they were. But their confidence has been eroded. And you think about
let me hold you up for a minute, okay? Let's define what confidence is. You know, we talk about losing it. We talk about having it. I wonder how many people actually know what it is.
Well, and it's, you know, the work that I've done with the Backbone Institute, competence, confidence, and risk-taking are the three elements of Backbone. And confidence is simply the belief that you have the wherewithal, the capacity to do things. Now, that means different things to different people, right? Little kids learning to ride a bike don't have the confidence that they can get on this thing even with training wheels and negotiate a block. You have people who have tremendous business experience and acumen who don't necessarily have the confidence to execute a sale of a division or to make an acquisition. You have people who are tremendously confident in their ability to stand in front of crowds and speak and don't have the confidence in a personal relationship to speak what's on their mind. And so it means various things to various people, but it is at the core the belief that you have the ability to do fill in the blank.
Well, let me try something here, okay? Hold on for a second. Uh-huh. We're going to create this. Jasmine, I got a question for you, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that if I put that headset on you and you got that microphone, you'd be comfortable talking?
Yes.
Yes. Confidence. 12 years old. She's confident.
Sure.
Do you hear it? Just
yes.
Automatic, because it would just be the thought didn't even hit her that what would this be, what the judgments, the rest
right.
of it. She just knows she can do it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so she's obviously had inputs in her life that have helped her understand, yes, she can. Well, gosh, we had a presidential candidate run on that theme, didn't he?
Yeah.
Yes, we can.
Wait.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, we can. What?
Yeah, wait. Yeah.
So, yes, the notion of confidence, just that the essence of belief in self is a fragile thing sometimes. Some people are never in circumstances surrounded by people who help them learn it. The tragedy of, you know, failing school systems, the tragedy of African-American students dropping, you know, by the wayside, 50% don't graduate. And we hear these stories and over and over and over. And so I think collectively, as a nation, as a society, our confidence has been shaken. And without getting too deep into this particular subject, I think because our confidence was shaken and we really didn't understand why, we picked the most eloquent promiser of stuff and put him at the seat of highest power in our nation. And many are coming to recognize that as perhaps not the wisest choice. But again, our confidence since then has continued to erode. So the whole question about, okay, so what do you do then, right? Let's say that you lost a job and you're, you know, struggling through, gosh, there's unemployment is so high, maybe there's not jobs in my community, et cetera, et cetera. How do I get my confidence back, right? How do I regain my mojo? And first of all, it is an inside job. every individual has to do this on his or her own, with support, of course. But the first decision has to be, I got to get past this. I'm bored with being mired in depression. I'm bored with, I'm sick of. But the first thing is to say, you know what, I got to get back. I got to get back to where I was. So the number one thing to do, the very first thing to do, is to turn off negative input, whether that's radio, whether that's TV, whether that's internet, whether that's, the tabloids at the grocery store, whether it's your nagging neighbor, whether it's your spouse that's driving you crazy, whether it's your kid who's telling you can't do anything, you gotta shut it off. And it is one of the most difficult things for people to do. I tell the story now as I'm speaking. I'm in technology rehab because I was one of these people who would get up early in the morning and check email, right? That's fine. And then check in this order, horoscope, weather, news. And that went from a quick 10-minute to a 30-minute to a 90-minute to 2 hours plus. And I found myself being dragged down to the depths of misery. I'm so sad of what's happening to people. So I had to stop that. And I had to literally rearrange my morning routine so that I was outside with the dog or I was doing something before I got sucked into this. It had become a habit. So turn off the sources of negative input. And people will say, well, why should I do that? The first question is, what can you personally do about the stuff that's going wrong in this country? If there is something you personally can do, go do it. If there's nothing you can do except be, become a victim of misery, turn it off. So that's number one, get away from the toxicity. Step two, then, is to take time to purposely feed yourself, your mind, and your psyche with things that lift you up. For some, it's turning on the Comedy Central. People love to laugh, right? For some, it's reading scriptures. For some, it's reading classic literature, the stories of man over nature, or, man transcending evil. Daily, I like to call them B12 shots. Daily, just quick conversations with people who lift you up. I've got a daughter. My youngest daughter is hilariously funny. She's raising two little girls. She's working full-time. Her husband's working full-time. They're selling their house. They're moving into... She is Irma Bombeck funny. Mm. And I love just a 2 or 3 minute conversation with her each day. Makes me laugh, makes me proud of her, sets me on a good path. Reading biographies of great leaders does two things. One, it helps you understand what were these people made of. And guess what? You have some of those same characteristics. And what were the challenges of their times? We lose that in our current society where things are coming at us so fast and it's all kind of superficial, bubblegum stuff. Listen to favorite music. How the mind responds to music, either, stimulated and generating ideas or soothed. And peaceful. I've got my little sleep machine. When I can't sleep, I plug it in, and it's got 3 one-hour-long tracks of music designed to calm the brainwaves. So there are any number of ways that people can intentionally fill themselves with good stuff. Third, one of the most important and also one of the most difficult, forget it. The past, the things you've screwed up in the past, forget about it. It's over. It's done. They represent moments in time and chapters of our lives that fade. It's like, we watch the sunset go down. That's now gone. That's history. We can be inspired by it. We can be, it can sear an image on our brain just like past mistakes, but it's gone. It's now history. You can't rewind. You can't redo. You can't undo. That was then. This is now.
Yeah, Susan, it's like saying, I'm in the moment. It's past.
Yeah.
Yeah, gone.
Yeah.
And if you blink your eyes, weren't you in high school a couple seconds ago?
Boy, you know what? And that algebra exam that I failed, and square root to Groot, nailed me calling in square root to Groot in the library. It's stuff that I was absolutely mortified by. That every once in a while, when I'm struggling to do something that's not going the way I want, I'll flash back to that.
Absolutely.
And I have to catch myself and say, oh, please, are you kidding me? That was 1973, 1970, whatever.
I was 100 years old then.
Yeah.
She agreed.
And we have to train ourselves.
Make a check mark.
Let it go. I'm agreeable.
She's agreeable. No, and I got that loud and clear, because what happens is that we go back to those things that were horrendous at the time, and we live them today. And there's where the problem lies. And the past is now, and we don't get that. And you can't jump into the future, and all you have is right now. And I really wonder what it would be like if everybody thought tonight at midnight you're going to die. It's over with. It's done.
Yes.
How different would your life be? What would you worry about? Would the things that are stressing you now stress you? No. And wouldn't it be interesting to live your life every day like that?
Yeah. Well, and in fact, there is an exercise that I do with a lot of my clients. And I say, okay, starting right now, right this very second, you got 6 months. And that seems like, you know, midnight tonight makes it much more obviously acute. But you've got 6 months. And we talk about it over the next couple of weeks. What in 6 months, what are you going to do? More importantly, what are you not going to do? And what I find over and over and over again, people saying, you know what, my boss is a jerk. I'm not getting involved in those conversations. 6 months from now, I'm gone. Right? So it doesn't really matter what he or she says. I got stuff to do. I've got things I've got to finish because in 6 months I'm done. I won't worry anymore. So many people say, you know what, the money thing? In 6 months, it's somebody else's anyway.
I have a small problem with the money thing. You're in trouble. You ready?
Go for it.
You're in trouble. I don't know if I can forgive you for this. You cost me $18.
Okay. Yeah.
Do you know why?
Why?
Okay. Well, the first thing that happened, I had a $10 bet that Radio Susie's daughter would marry this guy, and I lost. And so I say, oh, are you a $10? And then I couldn't remember the kind of car you got. So I said, okay, I'll take that $9 because she owed me a dollar. I'll take
nothing.
That $9 and I will bet that that was something that was, we'll split it. Well, I'll give you a note. And anyways, so then I forgot what kind of car you got. And I thought it was something else. And she said, no, it's what you have. And I said, I'll bet that $9 on it. I lost.
Uh-huh.
You've cost me $18.
Here's my question for you.
Yeah.
What did you learn from that?
Not to bet. To call
or,
you up.
No, more importantly, when you bet, you already are sure
know what
you
you're betting
right
on.
Yeah, research before you bet. That's so funny. But you know what? Let it go. That was then, this is now. It's all done.
I got to set her up for an $18 bet. It's coming.
See? You're planning for the future. You're confident that somehow you're going to get that money back. I love it.
Yes.
Absolutely love it.
I lost $18.
And this is, by the way, and joking aside, people who are not in a place where they're regaining or they're rebuilding their confidence will take that $18 loss and make it the reason why they're stupid, they're a loser, you know, nothing ever again is going to work well because, for heaven's sakes, I lost $18 on a stupid foolish
bet. You know what she just said to me? She just said, and I'm confident you're not getting that $18 back.
Oh, this is good.
She's been listening to you.
Yes.
Yes.
The planning will be fun.
Yeah, no, but it's true. And the one thing, before we run out of time, I want to get to number four, because number four is so critically important.
Yeah. Number four is to journal or make personal lists about things like things I'm grateful for. You know, at the end of the day, what about today are you grateful for? And sometimes it's simply, I made it through this day. You know, we all have those days. Keep track of things that you notice, things I noticed today. I started doing this a couple of years ago, and there's a neighbor in my kind of subdivision here who's got a beautifully manicured lawn, and I've always admired his house. And, well, it was last winter I was walking past his house, and for the very first time, it's probably the 400th time I've walked by, I noticed a little tree in his front yard that looked like a dandelion, that I could walk up to it, make a wish, and blow the rest of the leaves off the tree. I was charmed by that. So that's, when you look for things to notice, you look for things to notice. Your eyes open, you're attentive to what's going on around you. Write down things you accomplished today. We tend to have our to-do lists and we cross things off, but we generally don't take time to sit down and say, what did I get done today? All confidence-building stuff. Lessons I learned this week. lessons I learned this week makes me reflect on the conversations I've had, the things I attempted to do, the things that didn't work well, but what did I take from them? What did I learn? Proving to myself I have the capacity to learn and change.
Yeah.
Write down things that made me laugh. You know, your story of $18, your bet, that made me laugh. That's good. That fills me with good juices, right? The endorphins we kick in. Things that made me feel proud. What am I proud of this week? My daughter managing her life with the kids and her crazy life. What makes me proud? When I can start making those lists, I am compiling evidence of the goodness of my life. I'm also seeing evidence that my engagement and involvement with all of these things give me meaning, give my life purpose. When you start doing these kinds of things as a daily habit, your confidence can't help but come back. And in many cases, way beyond what it used to be, because you've now got all of this evidence. Very, very powerful stuff. We don't tend to do this. That's why I said early, you know, at the start of this, regaining your confidence is an inside job. It is purposeful. It is intentional. In the beginning, when you start doing these things, they feel weird. They feel corny. It's like, oh, really? I'm going to sit down and make a list of things I noticed? Yeah, I am. And guess what? I'm going to figure out that my energy level's up. And I'm kind of curious about what I'm going to find tomorrow that I missed today. Confidence, step by step by step, elevates. And the last thing is to reflect on those lists, whether it's once a week, whether it's every couple of weeks, and plan what you want to do next. Given what you're grateful for, given what you've noticed, given things you've already accomplished, what's next? How do you leverage what you've already done? How do you take what you've learned to take that next step and move forward? It's all about building competence, which leads to confidence, which helps us take risk.
And you get to like yourself.
And you get to like yourself.
Oh, if I don't like me,
powerful,
how am I going to like
powerful,
you?
Powerful, powerful, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really what it comes down to. And the stuff about, you know, what am I grateful for, what I've noticed, it's very important because it brings you into a position, it's a shift in your purpose. And I will use that word purpose again. If my purpose is to prove myself right about myself, that I'm never going to get anything and I'm always going to end up at the wrong end of the stick and so on and so forth, I'm going to find things to prove that to myself. But once I start looking outside that realm and then I begin to see other things, then all of a sudden life starts to change.
It does. And sometimes people are surprised. One of the most powerful ones is the thing that I noticed. And actually, I teach a leadership class, and I ask the students in the class to notice leadership exchanges. And to your point, the women who, and it's all women in the class, the women who have this victim mentality will almost invariably find leadership abuse situations and prove to themselves that leaders are bad people. If you are in a place of recognizing who you are and what opportunities you have, you will begin looking for positive or at least effective, let's say just effective leadership dynamics and learning from those. So you're right. If I think I'm bad and I'm never going to get any different, I'm going to find all the reasons to prove that to me, to keep me.
But now here's what makes you different than I am? What makes
you
different?
Are you asking me that question right now?
Yeah.
Where shall I start?
Anywhere.
I'm female, you're male, I live here, you live there, work. I mean, I can give you all those superficial things, but at the core?
At the core. What makes, why are we different?
I don't know that we are.
We're not. And the only difference is what you think, or what I think. That's what makes a difference.
Yeah.
If you think you're this and you think I'm that, then that's what causes us to be different. The key is it's how you think it. That's what makes the differences between the two of us. At core, there is no difference. Yeah, physically, of course, you know. But
you know
in the same time,
that just flashed in my brain as I was listening to you. Garanimals. Do you remember what garanimals are?
No.
There were kids' clothes, and they would have a giraffe or an elephant or a teddy bear or something, and parents would pick outfits, a giraffe top, a giraffe bottom. I just had the picture when you said, you know, the way you think and the way I think. We carry our Garanimal stickers around. I'm this
Garanimal. Absolutely.
I believe I'm this Garanimal. And you may see a completely different Garanimal, but I'm holding it. This is me. This is my identity. And if, to your point, if I can't begin to change that to a more positive, purposeful, powerful Garanimal, I'm going to stay where I am.
You bet. And you know why you're going to change? Oh, you know why you're going to stay where you're at? Lack of confidence.
Yes. Yeah.
I got to go. I got to go. This is wonderful. By the way, you know I could talk to you for hours. Website we can find you at.
Let me give you two. The current one that we've been talking about for, what, the last couple of years, www.executiveadvisorllc is really sort of a history of my work over the last 14 years. The one that we are building currently is backboneinstitute.com, where you will find information on confidence clinics for women and much more of the material that we were talking about this evening.
Wonderful. And by the way, when you do a confidence, you should invite me to speak. I would love to do that.
I would love to have you.
We create some very interesting things in that workshop, and they would leave with some very interesting ways to look at things.
Yeah.
Because
Let's not lose that thought, because I've been out talking with folks. The interest is absolutely tremendous. At the retail level, we started just kind of opening it up to whichever women were interested in, you know, could afford it. And we're now getting requests from corporations. In fact, I had a call just this afternoon from GE, the Global Research Center out in New York, is very, very interested.
Okay, you're doing stuff in China?
Here. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that'll be fun.
But we love you. You know that. Okay, we're running out of time. And thank you so much for joining us. We'll see you next week. We're going to stay here and wait.
Awesome. Thank you, Michael Ray.
Okay, good night.
Bye-bye.
Well, I stepped out the tub, I put my feet on the floor. I wrapped the towel around me and I opened the door. And then a splish splash, I jumped back in the bath. Well, how was I to know there was a party going on? There was a splishing and a splashing, reeling with the feeling, moving and a grooving, rocking and a rolling. Bing bang, I saw the whole gang dancing on my living room rug. Flip flop, they were doing the bop. All the tunes had the dancing bug. There was Lollipop with a Peggy Sue. Getting golly, Miss Molly was even there too. Well, a splish splash, forgot about the bath. I went and put my dancing shoes on. I was a splishing and a splashing. I was a rolling and a strolling. Yeah, I was a man.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. He's back, Mayor Eisenstein, graduate of the University of Illinois Medical School, and he is the CEO of Home First Natural Pharmaceuticals. He's a medical doctor and an attorney. Hey, Mayor, how are you?
Hey, Michael. It's so good to be back with you. I have a shocking news for everyone. Shocking.
Okay.
It's a recent study. Most American children are not getting enough vitamin D. It was the Journal of Environmental Health Perspectives. How shocking.
Now, wait. Let's redo that again. You've trained me well. They're not getting what?
Enough vitamin D3.
D3, no. Yes.
Yeah, and you know what's so sad about this? I hate conspiracy theories, because, you know, who cares about that? I mean, and unfortunately, it's going to be very difficult to avoid this. Just a few weeks ago, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the alleged organization of pediatricians that allegedly is out for the welfare and the health of children, has said that vitamin D testing is not necessary in children. I mean, can you believe this? I mean, this is like...
No.
Well, they're right. All they have to do is let them take vitamin D or stay in the sun. You know, but the reason for the testing is very simple, because still no one believes how serious this problem is. And it's a real serious health problem. I mean, it most probably is the most serious health problem of the country, because by correcting the vitamin D deficiencies, that they figure now 77% of children are severely deficient, and the number is equal to that of adults, we would lower, as I've said so many times, the incidence of so many diseases, ranging from colds and flu to heart disease to cancer. It's across the board. You know, it's not the answer for everything, but surely most probably is the most cost-effective treatment that we can give to this country.
You know, I've listened to ads for the last couple of months now. You and I have been talking about this for years now. I don't mean months, for years now. And I'm starting to hear more ads say, vitamin D3 with this, vitamin D3, take your vitamin D3, buy it here, yada, yada. So it's not like it's hidden anymore. There's many, many organizations that have done the research. You were the first, but they've done the research, and they are now touting the benefits of the vitamin D3.
And here's the study goes on to say the results challenge conclusions by the American Academy of Dermatology, which states that people will still make ample vitamin D3. And you can if you're out in the sun, but you need a sufficient amount of time to be in the sun. It's not a lot of time. Actually, it's only 15 or 20 minutes between approximately 10 o'clock until 2 o'clock. The reason why I bring this up right now is that's only in the summertime. In the wintertime, you know, the amount of vitamin D, and you have to have at least half your clothes off in order to make vitamin D, and it won't go through glass windows. You know, and so we're coming up to a time where we have to really be conscious of it, you know, because our vitamin D levels are usually the highest in the summer, the end of the summer, if we've been out in the sun. But let's assume we have. Now we're getting into a season where we have to be more careful about this, because as we get into the cold and flu season, and as you know, I'm a very, very big opponent of the flu vaccine because it's never done anything, you know. But we do have some wonderful treatment, vitamin D, and more vitamin D.
Now, by the way, I am totally behind you with this. There's no question about that. But I think there's a problem going on, and it's not just here. And we know we've talked about the pharmaceuticals before, and you were just with Rima LeBeau maybe within the last month or so. It's the Codex Alimentarius. There's where the problem is. And if we're not very careful, we're going to have people from the global, let's call it that way, that are going to be controlling the strength of the vitamins that we have here, and basically destroy it. And if they destroy it, what they've done is they've made money with the chemicals and the allopathic medicine.
100% right. I mean, there's no question about that. I mean, let me just add you one more thing. You know, we talk about that there's more depression in the winter than there is in the summer. And here's a study that also came out just a couple of days ago, published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. Vitamin D may reduce depression for women. No, I think it does the same for men, but they just happened to do the study on, so I think this goes along with it, because, you know, what do we always say if someone's not feeling good? We never tell them to go to Alaska or the North Pole. No. Someone's not feeling good. Says, you know something? You need a couple days off. Why don't you go to Florida or Southern California? You know, and I think we were kind of, our grandparents knew that was one of the ways of overcoming depression, which is partly not feeling good.
Yeah, and it's go under the sun. And what do you get from the sun?
Yeah, exactly. You know, what can you say, you know? But I think until they outlaw vitamin D, you know, I think that we have to realize that there's we got an easy solution. The supplements are inexpensive, you know, but I got something else very interesting. A company came out with a video game called Probiotics Video Game. And what they did was to tell people the value of these friendly bacteria. And it's called Micro Warriors, the Power of Probiotics. You know, how funny is that, you know? And I thought it was kind of a clever type of thing, you know, where they're trying to, using a video game to point out the value of these healthy strains of probiotics. And for anyone who's not familiar with probiotics, this has to become part of your lifestyle, because it's something we don't get enough in our diet. Because we used to get it because we used to We used to preserve our food with these friendly bacteria with a process called fermentation. But then as pasteurization came out, pasteurization has a wonderful effect in the sense of killing all the pathogenic bacteria, but also kills all the healthy bacteria, you know. And so now our system is lacking all these healthy, friendly bacteria, which just like vitamin D has been shown to have enormous amount of effect on our health, be it in heart disease, being in cancer, being in colds and flu. And so this is something we should absolutely think about taking all the time.
Now, by the way, and it's not expensive. It's probably one of the least expensive products that you can buy. I can't imagine anything that costs less than the D3.
Oh, it's pennies a day. This is all pennies a day, you know. And, you know, one of the reasons, Michael, that I've always focused on vitamin D and probiotics is because almost all the other supplements, and you and I take lots of supplements every day, but all the other ones aren't as critical because we'll get B vitamins if we eat well. We'll get A vitamins. We'll get C vitamins if we eat well. Just take enough greens and that. But you can't get vitamin D because the only place to get it is from the sun or from the fatty fish, but the fatty fish is so contaminated with mercury that it's most probably frightening to eat it, you know. And probiotics, the same thing. It's in fermented food, but it just almost doesn't exist anymore. Especially in the American diet, we have very little fermented food. There will be things like sauerkraut and kimchi. It's, you know, you know what kimchi is?
You know what, Mayor? Yes, I do. And if you ask me, I couldn't give you an answer, but I do know what kimchi is. I can't remember.
Right. It's a Korean, it's pickled cabbage. And it's a Korean food. And it's really fabulous. It's inexpensive, you know. And if you like spicy type things, everyone may want to go to a Korean market and a Japanese market. You could buy kimchi and see if you like it because all the cultures, all the ethnic cultures came up with foods that were healthy for you, can be made for pennies, for things like cabbage, you know, which is a very abundant, very inexpensive, but they would make it in different ways, and it became very appetizing, so it became a delicacy.
One of the things I think is important, you know, for fish, you said there's so much mercury in the fatty fish, but what do you get from fish? You get the omega-3 oils, and you can get that from you, which I have, in a gel cap.
Exactly, you know, and boy, there's been so much evidence on the value of omega-3s, and you're right, should I tell you something? I should mention that also, something that we used to be able to get in the past, but very difficult and easy to get now, the omega-3 fatty acids, you know, and I can tell you, people say, well, Dr. Einstein, how much should I take? Well, I'll tell you how much I take. My youngest son is a weightlifter, and so he says in the gym, he said, all the athletes there, they take a handful every day. So I think that must be the right amount to take. You know, and you can't overdose of this. I mean, this is not, you can't overdose with vitamin D, you can't overdose with probiotics, and you can't overdose with omega-3 fatty acids.
Mayor, there's something I'm going to try to say because I've never said this one before, but it's one I'm going to be on your doorstep for because we're talking about something that's to support healthy blood flow, circulation. I'm going to give it a shot. Natokinase. Is that something?
Natokinase, you know.
That's what I said.
You know,
yeah.
That's something I've looked into, and it's a Japanese, I'm trying to remember what, I take it every day, you know, but it has the same effect as a blood thinner, but a natural blood thinner, you know, and I'm
like
trying
if you took an aspirin.
Where it comes from, you know, I when I dig deep into my brain, I'll remember, you know, and we've always carried it, in our store, but we've never really promoted it a lot only because, and most probably should. It's a really good product, you know. I think it's a fermented. It's also a fermented.
One of them.
I'll come up with what it is exactly.
But the most important thing, you know, even getting away from the what's fermented. Oh, it's soy food. Okay.
Soy, you know.
It's
an enzyme extracted and purified from a Japanese food called natto. And natto is a food made from fermented soybeans.
Now, by the way, the thing that has got me looking at it, it supports capillary strength and vascular health. And if it's Japanese, it's the way I said it. Natsukanise.
Oh, you most probably had it right. You know, and there's no doubt about it that, and a lot of people have said, and a lot of the scholars in supplements have said that it is a absolute alternative to aspirin, which they're recommending to adults, you know, especially men over 40, 45. And I have never been able to wrap myself around that, but I could surely wrap myself around nattokinase. Thank you. I'm going to look into it more in the next week.
I'm going to order some.
Yeah, yeah. I tell you, well, we've carried it for years, and I take it every day, but I talk so much about vitamin D and probiotics that I've got to bring this more into the front.
No, I'm going to get some. I'm going to talk about it on the radio. But there's something, very quickly. I saw a product, and I can't remember what it was. I've got it here somewhere. It's a pill, and it'll make you gain weight. And I was going to call you about it to see if this stuff was safe or not.
You're because definitely not on my radar now, Michael Ray.
I know.
In fact, you're going to lose about 70% of your listening audience who struggle every day. And I'm saying that only because that's the statistics. You know, 30% of people don't struggle but still have the problem. You know, it's interesting because people say to me, Dr. Eisenstein, now you've lost lots of weight and you want to lose a little bit more weight. He says, when do you think you'll be finished? I said, when I reach my maker, you know, I mean, because there's no end to this, you know, in a sense. And it's become a serious global problem, the obesity problem, you know. And there's no easy answers to this, you know. And I think we've got some we don't have any solutions. We have some temporary answer, and temporary is for the rest of your life.
Yeah, but when I bring it up, it does one thing for me, Mayor. It does. It builds my I Hate Michael Ray fan club.
No one hates you. You know?
Why is it that everybody wants to join when I say I can eat 3 meals, 2 desserts, and lose a half a pound the next day?
Well, but let me tell you something.
Growing daily. Every time I do that, somebody wants to be the chairman in the city.
No, because let me tell you something, because you don't tell the truth also. You may do that, and then for 3 days you don't eat anything.
Well, that's true, too.
Yeah, about 5 or 10% of people in this world have a built-in mechanism that they can indulge themselves, and then their body re-regulates itself over the next couple of days. It's the way all of us are supposed to be, but for some reason we all aren't.
Nah, I just get a very rapid metabolism, that's all.
No, let me tell you, if you count up the calories that you're eating, it's not as much as most people who weigh more.
Nuts. Okay, I'm going to amp up on the chocolate cake. I'm here. Website.
Well, no, as long chocolate's very healthy, as long as defatted chocolate and with no sugar in it and added sugar. I mean, chocolate itself is a very bit. They put all the sugar in it. That's what makes it unhealthy.
It's the dark chocolate. Okay, the website. Website we can find you at.
HomeFirst.com. It's HomeFirst.com. We got lots of wonderful things coming up in the next couple of weeks. I'm going to be giving a webinar, should you get the flu vaccine. It's going to be September 13th, and I'll let more people know about it as we get a little bit closer. And I'm also going to be speaking in Dallas on the 17th or 18th of September, and that's going to be on how I've lost more than 100 pounds and help doctors implement the same programs in their practice.
I got it. And by the way, thank you so much for joining us. You know I always appreciate you.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Michael Ray. Have a good evening and a wonderful week. Be well.
Take care. Good night.
Thank you.
Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think
of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Robert Hardy with us. He's the author of The Bosses in Incapable, Incompetent, and Ineffective. He's had more than three decades of experience as an electrical engineer, a computer scientist with multinational corporations. He's conducted business seminars in Russia, the Ukraine, China, and he currently serves on the board of several nonprofits, including Winston-Salem's Sister Cities International. Robert, hi. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. The Boss from Hell. I guess there's a lot of people that have had them, and as much experience as you've had when you've traveled and done the things that you've done, the bad bosses, where did they come from? You know, is there a school that trains them to be that way? It seems as though the worse the boss, it also not affects the employee, but it affects the bottom line of the company.
Well, you know, a lot of people ask that question. I've asked it myself. Like, where do these bad bosses come from? Now, there's a number of theories, and I think that we have, based on the news, with all the kids and the online internet and so forth, we're turning out bad people here that are going to turn into bad bosses. But what I think I have seen most in my own career here is they don't start out as bad bosses. They're thrown into a situation. It's like the old Peter principle that we remember from the 60s. Everybody advances to a state of incompetence. And I've seen people who change their personalities. And I believe that if they had stayed the way they were, and as they move into management and become bosses, they wouldn't be so bad. I think they start out good, and then they just get bad.
You know, Robert, let me give you a prime example of the Peter principle. You get a great salesperson. This person just does, you know, top selling month after month after month, and they've been there. They're that good. They put them into management. They're a wonderful salesperson, but they're an okay manager. And then they've been there for long enough and they bring them up to the bosses category. They're a lousy boss, an okay manager, and a tremendous salesperson. That's the height of incompetency. They've gone beyond their ability to be competent in the position that they're in.
Well, that's what happens. And I think that perhaps in promoting a person, they should be working at that one level above their job description, and then when they get promoted, it's a promotion based on what he's already doing, and you can, I think that's a way of preventing that.
Oh, absolutely. No question about it. I know one of the things you address, which I think is very interesting. I've got your press release in front of me right now. It's when you don't know that a boss is a bad boss, and that can happen. And then by the time you find out, well, it's too late at that point. But how do you know whether a boss is a bad boss? Are there warning signs? Are there symptoms? Are there signals?
Well, the way I can answer that is to say, nobody needs to tell you. You'll know when you don't get along or when you don't like your boss. Now, when you're going in for the new job, or you're getting a promotion yourself, or through a reorganization or whatever, when you end up with a new boss, quite often you don't have any choice. And if you're moving into a new company as a new employee, you certainly don't know. Now, I can remember years ago when I interviewed for jobs, I sort of had a tendency to ask the other workers who would be my associates some questions. But I guess you have to be pretty careful in doing that. So it's hard to know. You just don't know until, but when you get there, believe me, you'll know you're there.
It's got to be scary to, you know, for people. They get into a situation, you got the bad boss, you don't know whether you can handle it or not handle it, you don't want to lose the job, and at the same time, you don't want to stay in that same position. That's got to be a real double-edged sword and a real tightrope to walk.
It definitely is. And I like to look at the bosses and categorize different kinds of bosses, like and why and how do they get there. One is the authoritarian, and that's like the military. You know, you do what he says because he's in authority. He's put there. We have a society here, and probably in most places, it's in the first place comes to the Chinese. We defer to age. We respect older people. Expert in the field. Another way of characterizing a boss is a democratic, like he was put there by his people or recommended, and based on experience. The problem, though, with any of these is the workers or the employees like a person because they also like for a person to come in from the ranks. They don't look kindly at a new boss that's brought in from the outside unless they all recognize that it's an area where they don't have the proper guidance from within, and they bring in something from the outside. Things can always go wrong in any of these levels, and by somebody else's theory here, if things can go wrong, they will.
Sure.
So, I think that in more cases than any, they simply change. Now, not being a psychologist or a psychiatrist, I have no knowledge of why that happens, but and I even look back in my own case. People have told me, says, boy, you've mellowed over the years. And I guess that's true. But I know that also that the people that I enjoyed working for the most were long-time experienced bosses. Now, however, there's some catches to that, too. He may be a long-time boss because he's not promotable. And for some people, that's not good because one way of getting a promotion yourself is to follow your boss. Get him promoted first, and then he'll promote you. So there's all kinds of things to think about.
Now, by the way, what was it early on, because this wasn't your original field, what was it early on that caused you to look at this in the first place and then eventually write about it?
Well, my field has been kind of varied. I started out as an engineer, and then I got a degree in industrial management and then a master's degree. And I learned the most about management from a big organization, NASA. Now, I don't think I say that anywhere in my bio, but they have a terrific team because everything has to go by the clock and by the calendar, and everything is synchronized when you've got so many people. And I learned to apply the things that I had learned in school. Now, most people are promoted from the ranks with no management training whatsoever. Now, I came out when I retired. I went through a number of different engineering phases, and finally ended up in research and development as an individual contributor, which says I go out and hustle my own money. I come up with the ideas for something, and if I can get somebody to support it, then I'm off and running. But then I left. I left the big company and went to a volunteer organization that works with the name of a SCORE, that works with the Small Business Administration. And I worked with small businesses doing counseling. And that's how I got involved with the Russians and the Ukrainians and the Chinese, by going to these places and teaching these things I think it's fair to say that we do excel in the management techniques. Otherwise, we wouldn't be where we are. You might laugh at that and say, well, we're not so well off right now economically, but we'll recover, and we always have. And other people, believe me, are very much interested in how we do it. So I've kind of made the rounds there, so to speak.
You know, the interesting point is, I'm listening to you, in all of the different places that you've worked, you know, would you define a boss in, let's say, the Ukraine as opposed to China, as opposed to here? We have a different culture, a different society, and a different way of looking at things, viewing things. So would you define a boss, and are the same symptoms of a bad boss the same here in the U.S. as they would be in China or in the Ukraine?
Well, I'm sure that they have bad bosses just like we have bad bosses, but there are definitely, as you just said, some very definable cultural differences. Let me take Russia and Ukraine. They're part of the old USSR, and the work that I did there, I worked mostly with professors, and they're smart people, well-educated people, but somebody has to give them the go-ahead. They know what they want to do, but they come from, I guess, generations of communist or socialist, and they do what they're told, and they don't get out of that rut. So I found them to be very dependable on me to tell them. They know exactly what they want to do and what they could do and so forth, but somebody's got to say, do it. That's what they were used to. Now, in the coming generations, see, they've got three generations of people. The old folks are retired, and they don't have much, but they're not used to much. The middle generation is struggling because they don't speak English, they don't know Western marketing and business, and they don't know computers. But the generation that's important now are the college students. They know all of those things, and they follow after our pattern. Now, if I switch all the way over on the other side of the world to China, they like, it's more like a majority rule, like a democratic. It requires a consensus almost of everybody in the group for anything to happen. So they are totally different. There are three different management styles there.
Now, by the way, when they're waiting to be told what to do, there are countries, if they don't do what they're told to do, they don't go home at night and they never get seen again. So there's a little bit of consequence there that we don't necessarily have to, that we have here. But at the same time, the symptoms of a bad boss are probably going to be inherent in every country, and it's going to pretty much be the same thing if you brought it to the surface, even though culturally they would be just a little bit different.
Yes.
We're starting to run out of time. Let me ask you this. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I probably should have given you that right off here. My book is thebossisin.com.
Thebossisin.com.
And the website? And that will take you to me. And there's a paragraph or two about me and what I've done and what I've been doing and some description of the book The Boss Is In. And so I would like for everybody to know about that that website, thebossisin.com.
Wonderful. Robert, we're just about out of time. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Well, thank you for having me, and I've certainly enjoyed it. And we could go on and on talking about this.
Oh, that's one of my favorite subjects. No question. All right, we're about out of time, and I want to thank you again so much for joining us. Good night.
Good night.
As you're filing out the door, as they say in this bit, that's all there is. There isn't any more. We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
As friends, your cheers and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again, and the evening